And now, it's your turn with Dave Malarkey. 724-283-2525. It's Butler County's only live call-in talk show. It's your turn. Weekdays from 1230 to 2 on 680 AM WISR and worldwide on the internet at WISR680.com. It's your turn. 724-283-2525. And now, it's your turn with Dave Malarkey.
Well, good afternoon once again, everyone. Welcome. Nice to have you with us on the Friday edition of It's Your Turn. And we're aiming right at the Veterans Day weekend now that we've passed the noon hour here on a Friday. Veterans Day, of course, falling on a Saturday this year. We're celebrating a little early in salute to our veterans. Earlier this week, we had a marvelous chat with Roy Ramone. He's the 2017 Butler County Veteran of the Year. We also had John Cyprian with us earlier in the week, giving us details of the activities that are coming up tomorrow here in Butler, the parade and the luncheon and so on and so forth. Yesterday, we took a listen to an interview that I had done with David Widenhofer, local man from the Hermann area originally, who wrote a book detailing the stories of seven men from our area who served in the Korean War. And boy, we've had a lot of feedback from that interview that we aired yesterday. We're doing it again today, not that same interview, of course, but recently I've had the great pleasure, I've been blessed, really, to do some interviews with World War II historians, other military historians, and we're going to listen to those today, listen to some of those today, including a look at Pearl Harbor, maybe some of the insight into a little bit more that really happened at Pearl Harbor. We also plan to talk today with acclaimed military historian John McManus about Omaha Beach on D-Day. And coming up in just a moment or so, we're going to talk with our first guest, an interview that I did a couple of years back, actually, with Bruce Gamble, retired military guy. Have you heard of Baba Black Sheep and Pappy Boyington, and World War II squadron? Well, we'll get the real story from Bruce Gamble coming up here in just a moment or so. One of our sponsors on the program today is Gone Postal Butler. They package your items for shipping. What could be more convenient, huh? Especially as we head into the holiday period here. A lot of folks be mailing a bunch of stuff. You can ship it any way you want when you deal with Gone Postal Butler. FedEx, UPS, U.S. Postal Service. They are located just off Newcastle Road on Shockey Lane. Now, that's right behind Kings and Villa Grande. It's in the Shockey Mini Storage Complex there. You can't miss it. Right behind Kings and Villa Grande restaurants. We'll give you a phone number in a second. You can check in with them for more information on their services. They do more than just package your items for shipping. They offer scanning service, copying service, faxing, mailbox rentals, greeting cards. There's an official notary there in case you need to get something notarized before it goes out. You can even pick up a lottery ticket at your friendly neighborhood shipping center, Gone Postal Butler. Telephone number for more info, 724-841-0044. 841-0044. Okay, let's once again take a listen to an interview that we did earlier about Pappy Boyington and the Black Sheep Squadron in World War II in the Pacific with Bruce Gamble. Welcome, listeners. Nice to have you on this segment of It's Your Turn here on WISR. Dave Malarkey is my name. And our guest joins us by telephone today. He is author Bruce Gamble. We're going to be talking about his World War II history. Actually, it's more than World War II. It's the history of swashbucklers and black sheep. First of all, Bruce Gamble, nice to meet you. Nice to have you with us for a few minutes here today.
Yeah, it's great to join you.
Bruce Gamble has written other books about the black sheep, and we may mention those if time permits because I think they're still available, but we want to concentrate on the latest, Swashbucklers and Black Sheep. First of all, Bruce, there will be some of our listeners who are not World War II historians, but either through the movies or television, they will be aware of the Black Sheep Squadron. They've heard about that before, right?
Absolutely. The Black Sheep were probably made the most famous by the action-adventure series that was on NBC back in the 1970s, with Robert Conrad playing the starring role as a real-life Marine Major Pappy Boynton, who commanded a Marine Fighting Squadron 214 in the Solomon Islands.
Well, there was a Pappy Boynton, of course, but unfortunately, as happens many times in the movies and in television, a lot of the things that people know about Pappy Boynton were either inaccurate or kind of mythical, I guess, huh?
Well, they were. You know, Conrad was probably the perfect choice to play that role because of his demeanor and even his stature. They were both kind of similar in size and in pugnacity, so he was a good choice to play Pappy Boynton.
Yeah, he was the guy who later on did the battery commercials, right? Knocked that chip off my shoulder. Wasn't that Conrad?
That's it. I dare you to knock this off my shoulder.
So that
he was apropos. He really was to play that part.
Let me ask a little bit about your interest in World War II and specifically the Black Sheep Squadron. First of all, a little bit about your background and talk about your service in the military, first of all, Bruce.
Well, I flew for 8 years as a navigator or flight officer, kind of like Goose in Top Gun, only I wasn't in that beautiful Tomcat. I was in a plane called the Sky Warrior, a carrier-based reconnaissance jet. And I flew for 3 years over in the Pacific and then was back in Pensacola on instructor duty when I was diagnosed with a spinal cord tumor. And the surgery for that ended my military career. But Pensacola is home to a wonderful world-class aviation museum, the National Naval Aviation Museum. And I began to volunteer there, which suddenly led to some opportunities to do some oral history collection. And I met one of the original pilots from the Black Sheep Squadron back in 1991. And he told me the real story of the squadron and then made it possible for me and my family to join the squadron when they had a 50th anniversary reunion in New Orleans in 1993. So the short of it is that I got together with about 20 of the original guys who flew with Greg Boynton, got their stories, collected photographs and logbooks, and then published the narrative history of the unit called The Black Sheep in 1998. You made some reference earlier to previous books, and that was my first one. So I've been interested in the squadron for over 20 years now, but I had collected all these great photos, but never had an opportunity to put them into a narrative book. Those typically only have small galleries of pictures. So I had a couple hundred photos available and also knew some great artists and decided that a pictorial history would be a great companion to that original book.
Yes, and that indeed is the subtitle of Bruce Gamble's latest book, Swashbucklers and Black Sheep, A Pictorial History of Marine Fighting Squadron 214 in World War II. And this is available, I'm assuming, Bruce, in all the places where we usually find books these days?
Yes, it is. It can be found in your brick-and-mortar bookstores like Barnes & Noble and others like that, and also through the usual online sellers like Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all of them. It's pretty widely available.
We should also mention, before I talk a little bit more about the book, that Bruce Gamble is a native of Pennsylvania. In fact, you went to Penn State, right?
That's correct. Graduated from there in 1980 with a degree in pre-law, and then got recruited into the aviation program and went down to Pensacola to learn to fly. I thought I had 20/20 vision. Turned out I had 20/25 vision, and back in those days you could not get corrective surgery. So rather than qualifying as a pilot, I learned aviation as a flight officer and did all kinds of, it was just terrific. It was a great career.
And you flew off aircraft carriers?
That's correct.
Now,
the Sky Warrior was an electronic reconnaissance aircraft with a fairly large crew of seven.
That was my next question, because my knowledge of aircraft carriers comes from the films, I'm sorry to say. I have no personal experience, and I was not aware that they had, that there were aircraft that had a sizable crew that was able to operate off a carrier. I thought it was just one and two-man planes.
Most of them were, you're right, but this was one unusual aircraft. In fact, it was the largest plane to operationally work off of aircraft carriers, and it served through the 1970s and 80s in that configuration. The A3 was around for a long time, almost 50 years.
Well, I have to say, as an outsider and a layperson, that I have to think landing on an aircraft carrier is going to be one of the most nerve-wracking things you can do in the world. Maybe painting bridges would come close. I don't know.
Yeah, it's like, it's one of those things that when you're young and you don't know any better, it's thrilling. But honestly, I was along for the ride. I did not have controls. I couldn't have done anything if we were in trouble. But I had absolute faith in the pilots I flew with. They were great guys. They trained really hard. The most nerve-wracking time was at night, and then heavy seas. When you had a high sea state, and even a 90,000-ton carrier can pitch and roll surprisingly to a surprising degree, and that can get a little scary at night.
Your title might intrigue some of our listeners who have even a cursory knowledge of the Black Sheep Squadron in World War II, because they're seeing swashbucklers and the Black Sheep. Well, what you need to know is that the Black Sheep didn't start out being called the Black Sheep, right?
No, that's right. They had an iteration that the first formation of the squadron was a group of 28 pilots who had a couple of combat tours before Pappy Boynton came on the scene. And on their second tour, they decided to call themselves the Swashbucklers, based on the whole pirate theme of the Corsair fighter that they transitioned into for their second combat tour. But the name never became official. It was not recognized by the Marine Corps. So it was just a temporary nickname that lasted for about 6 or 7 weeks. But I wanted to honor that group. They had an important role to play. Henceforth, the name of the book starts out with honoring that group with the Swashbucklers. And the book also gives a nod to the late war group that served on the carrier Franklin. They had a real tough time. And also to the squadron and its service in the Korean War, with a little bit of color photography featured in the back of the book about the current war on terror. So I try to cover the whole squadron service, but it concentrates on World War II.
When did the squadron become known as the Black Sheep? Was that when Pappy Boynton arrived?
Absolutely. This new group wanted their own identity, but they had been formed from a bunch of pilots who were not assigned to a combat squadron. They were all associated with a replacement pool in the Solomon Islands, and because they didn't have any association with a combat squadron, they felt like they didn't belong to anybody, and so the name of the Black Sheep came along as a way to, number one, recognize Pappy Boynton, who really was sort of the Black Sheep of the Marine Corps, at least among fighter pilots, and also kind of acknowledge that they had been formed in an unusual fashion overseas. So the Black Sheep was a clever name.
We're talking, for listeners who may have joined us a little bit late here on this segment of It's Your Turn, with Bruce Gamble, author. He's a veteran and later an author. Started to write when he began to volunteer at the National Museum of Naval Aviation following his active career. There's one other thing we should mention, and I have to take a quick break and we'll pick up our conversation. But there's another reason that you got very interested in the Pacific Theater, and that's because your dad was there during World War II, right?
Absolutely. He was a pilot aboard a B-29 bomber named Sweet Chariot and flew combat missions over Japan. He was based on Guam, and coincidentally, that was the first duty station I was assigned to after I got my wings. So we both were on the same Smile Island, just 40 years apart. But I had an opportunity to go visit the airfield where he had been based which was really interesting. All that was left were the runways, but it was really interesting to see where he had flown his combat missions from.
And those were long-range bombing missions to the Japanese mainland?
That's correct. He flew in the 315th Bomb Wing, which flew a special B-29 fitted with an external radar that allowed them to bomb their targets at night. And they tried to hit relatively small targets, such as oil refineries, so that they could later go back and do assessments on the accuracy. And it turned out that radar bombing at night was highly accurate, and they flew very long-range missions from Guam all the way to the northern part of the Japanese homeland. Some of the missions lasted as long as 18 hours.
We forget, don't we, that radar was still in its developmental stages during World War II. We take it for granted today.
That's correct. Yeah, the Brits had some good land-based radar for seeing the incoming German raids even during the Battle of Britain. But airborne radar really didn't come into common use until the late part of the war. But they were even able to fit it onto fighters. The famous F-6F Hellcat had a little bulge on one wing for night fighter capability. There was the famous Black Widow, the P-61, had the radar on that for night fighter use. So it underwent a very rapid development towards the second half of World War II.
We'll take a quick break. We'll pick up our conversation with author Bruce Gamble here on It's Your Turn on WISR. Be back right after these words.
Your pet is loved. Your pet is a member of your family. So when your pet dies, your pet deserves respectful care. If you choose cremation, which so many have, consider the impeccable, sensitive, local service provided by Butler Pet Cremation and Glenn Thompson Miller. Here's our pledge. Your pet will be cremated individually in our impeccable facility here in Butler. We assure you that the cremains are assuredly your pets and your pets alone. Before you make your decision, ask how other facilities perform. Individual cremation? It's an important and sensitive question. Bring your pet to us or we'll come to your home. When the time comes, tell your veterinarian that you prefer Butler Pet Cremation and Glenn Thompson Miller. He's a pet parent, too. Call us, 724-287-3707, 287-3707, or www.butlerpetcremation.com. Butler Pet Cremation and Glenn Thompson Miller.
Helping one another is what Central Electric Cooperative's Family Fund is all about. This program helps members pay their electric bill when times are tough. The funding comes from members who round up their electric bills to the nearest whole dollar. Members can also make a one-time or monthly donation. In addition, Central Electric employees also donate to this program. Funds are distributed by local social service agencies to qualified members. If you are a Central Electric member, why not donate to the Family Fund today? To learn more about energy assistance, new products, and saving money on your energy bill, visit our website at www.central.coop. This is Ken Molesky with Central Electric Cooperative, powering everyday life for 80 years. Central Electric Cooperative is an equal opportunity provider and employer.
Welcome back, listeners. If you're joining us a little bit late on this segment of It's Your Turn here on WISR, welcome. My name is Dave Malarkey. Our guest visits with us by telephone today. He is a military veteran and now his military historian and author, Bruce Gamble. We're talking about his recently published book, Swashbucklers and Black Sheep, a pictorial history of Marine Fighting Squadron 214 in World War II. You have a lot of illustrations. I've read some of the feedback from reviewers of your book on some of the websites online, Bruce, and that's what everyone seems to mention. They like the large format, the large pages. It really gives you a chance to make these photographs and illustrations pop out.
They do. They're outstanding photographs. I had the pleasure of meeting more than 20 of the original members of the squadron and collected their photographs, and they had some amazing shots. It was surprising to me that so many of the guys actually had cameras over in the islands, and they took a lot of photos on the ground, so most of those are candid photos. Of course, they really couldn't carry a Leica or even a Kodak camera with them in the cockpit during combat flights, so there aren't very many aerial shots, a few, but not many. So to fill in some of those gaps, I got with artist friends of mine and had them create or allow me to use some of their existing works to depict the black sheep in their aerial combat.
You must, Bruce Gamble, have felt very privileged to talk with 20-some members of the Black Sheep Squadron, and sad to say, timely as well, because we are losing our surviving World War II veterans now very, very quickly.
Yeah, we are. That's the shame, of course, is just Father Time. What is the old saying? You know, you can't avoid death or taxes. And
what about Boyington himself? I seem to recall that he was actually taken prisoner, wasn't he? Wasn't he a POW?
He was. Yep. He was shot down on January 3rd, 1944, in the act of tying the existing record among American pilots for the most aerial victories. Joe Foss of Guadalcanal fame in World War II and Eddie Rickenbacker of World War I fame had the existing record of 26 victories, and Greg Boyington got his 26th victory on the day he was shot down and taken prisoner. He spent about 20 months as a captive of the Japanese. He was awarded a Medal of Honor while he was a prisoner, and then when he got repatriated at the end of the war, he received his Medal of Honor from President Truman.
Did the Japanese know who he was, or was his notoriety not that well known at the time?
I think they probably had a good feeling of who he was, because they were pretty well tapped into American newspapers. We've always had a very transparent society, so the Japanese had their means of getting American newspapers, or at least seeing the headlines. And Boyington's Medal of Honor was well publicized, so I have a feeling that they were pretty aware of who they had. He was mistreated some, but not as badly as other prisoners, and actually was able to get a job working in a kitchen, and so he wasn't as starved as a lot of the other Japanese POWs were. I should say American POWs mm-hmm. In Japan.
What happened to Boyington after the war?
He struggled. Unfortunately for him, alcoholism was a common thread throughout his whole adult life, and after the war he had a lot of famous meltdowns, you might say, and kind of brought some disgrace on the Marine Corps. He was cashiered out of the Corps after just 2 years of sort of public, some bad publicity. So by 1947, he was out just 2 years after they handed him a Medal of Honor. Hmm. And then he struggled with odd jobs and different things. And then all of a sudden, he wrote a best-selling autobiography called Baba Black Sheep.
Yeah.
And then had a real roller coaster life after that. He had a lot of ups and downs.
We're speaking with Bruce Gamble, author of, his latest work that we're talking about today, Swashbucklers and Black Sheep, A Pictorial History of Marine Fighting Squadron 214 in World War II. They were known as the Black Sheep, commanded by Pappy Boyington. Greg was his real name, right?
Yes, Greg was his real name, and interestingly, the pilots did not call him Pappy during the war. That was really an outgrowth of publicity by the media. They called him Gramps, or Greg, either one. He was sort of known teasingly as a grandpa, just because he was older and had some children, and so they called him Gramps or called him Greg. It was a very casual group.
We tend to think of some of these units as disappearing into the wild blue yonder at the end of World War II. The Black Sheep did not. This squadron continued on in further service, in fact, all the way up, I believe, until Afghanistan. Is that right?
Yeah, they're still active. They're still flying. And so, yes, they served in every conflict since World War II, including Korea and Vietnam and over in the desert.
How far does your pictorial history go, Bruce?
It does have a few pages in the back that gives a nod to the current squadron, Dave. They have there are some beautiful color photographs in the last several pages that show the Harrier in action, and it's some of those photos, as you mentioned earlier, are full page spreads, and they're really dramatic.
I couldn't help but kind of shake my head a little bit as I read some of your bio. We had already mentioned your dad flying in a B-29 from Guam in World War II, and you were able to visit there. You indicated, you were granting an interview. By the way, folks, if you're thinking to yourself, Bruce Gamble, where do I know that name? Why am I picturing this guy? You may well have seen him. Bruce is being very modest about his accomplishments. He's a featured historian in documentaries that have been produced by the History Channel, by Fox News, by PBS, by the Pritzker Military Library. So you may well have seen him on television. But I was reading in your bio about how you started out when you were a kid reading a couple of Cornelius Ryan books, A Bridge Too Far and The Longest Day. I did exactly the same thing, Bruce. My dad was in the 82nd Airborne in World War II, jumped into Normandy, so you better believe that Cornelius Ryan books were front and center on our family bookshelf at home.
I'm sure, and kudos. That's an understatement to say kudos to your dad. Any of those guys who jumped in the 82nd or the 101st, I mean, those guys were real heroes. So that's fantastic that you have that heritage and that interest in military history. Cornelius Ryan was a fantastic writer, somebody to emulate, and I just thought he was so interesting because he portrayed what the little guys did. I don't mean little as in stature, but you know, just the everyday privates. You know, the guy who was hanging from the steeple there at St. Mary Glees. I think Cornelius Ryan would make these everyday privates and sergeants such a big part of the story, and I tried to do the same thing with my books, and I think it's a successful formula.
Yeah. I was Private John Steele, by the way, who got stuck on the steeple in the town of St. Mary Glees. I can remember my dad giving me a copy of the longest. I don't know how old I was. I was a kid, and I got interested, and I was able to visit Normandy before my father died, and visit some of the places where we thought he was, because we really didn't know. You know, after the 82nd and the 101st jump, all the roadsides had been removed, and my father was captured and taken prisoner 6 days after D-Day, and we were able to piece together from reunions and so on where we thought he was, and I went over and visited those sites, copy of The Longest Day in my in my backpack the whole way along. It was quite a thing, quite an emotional part of my life, I'll tell you that.
I'm sure it was, and you're very fortunate to be able to walk in his footsteps and to see where he served. That's a wonderful thing. The Pacific is a little different because the islands are so, even now, almost inaccessible to most people. You can get into what was Guadalcanal, which is now, I think it's pronounced Sonora, but there are, honestly, civil wars going on almost all the time between some of the native factions, and so it's actually pretty dangerous to go into some of the islands at particular times. It's hard to tell when it's safe and when it's not. But just to get out to the islands, it's a little easier now than it was, but not that much. So very few people actually have the opportunity to get out to the Pacific and see where our heroes fought.
I've got to let you go here. Folks can learn a little bit more about you.
www.brucegamble.com. It's pretty easy to look up. There was a hockey player named Bruce Gamble who is deceased, but if you just put Bruce Gamble into Google or Bing or one of the search engines, it'll be pretty easy to find my website.
Bruce, what a treat to meet you and be able to talk to you today. I really, really enjoyed the conversation.
Yeah, me too. And I think this was a great interview. I appreciate the opportunity very much.
Enjoyed it. Thanks, Bruce.
Me too. Thank you.
So long now.
Okay. Take care, Dave.
Thanks. Up next, a little backstory on Pearl Harbor as we continue our salute to veterans this day before Veterans Day. We'll be right back. Does your pharmacy tell you your wait time for a prescription will take a half an hour or longer, or maybe won't even be ready until the next day? Don't think this is your only option. At Institute Hill Pharmacy, we have made it a priority to take care of our customers' needs first because your time is precious. Most wait times are under 10 minutes. So don't you think it's time to make a switch to Institute Hill Pharmacy, located at 937 East Jefferson Street, or find us on Facebook, Institute Hill Pharmacy, an old-fashioned pharmacy just the way you remember.
Since 1938, Hunter Truck Sales has been a leader in the trucking industry. With 19 locations, we've grown to be the largest heavy truck dealership network in the Northeast. Proudly, Hunter has employed generations of families in the region and was recently honored to be named 2017 Family Business of the Year by the Pittsburgh Business Times. Check it out online at huntertrucksales.com for truck inventory, careers, and locations. Across our network, Hunter will provide solutions for all your trucking needs.
We have a wonderful opportunity today, listeners, here on the It's Your Turn program on WISR. And if you're just joining us today, welcome. My name is Dave Malarkey. We are talking with the co-authors of a new book on Pearl Harbor. And, of course, we're marking the 75th anniversary of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. The title of the book is A Matter of Honor, Pearl Harbor, Betrayal, Blame, and A Family's Quest for Justice. The authors are Anthony Summers and Robin Swan, and we have them both on the line with us here today. Anthony, Robin, nice to have you with us today.
Thank you so much.
There have been a lot of books written about Pearl Harbor down through the years. Actually, there have been quite a few out this year, marking the 75th anniversary. Yours is a little bit different, though, right? You're taking a specific look, Anthony, at one phase of this story?
Well, we did take a special focus, and for a curious reason. You know, our last book was about the 9/11 attacks, which is, the only other occasion, except Pearl Harbor, when the United States was attacked with terrible casualties and great loss by an enemy on its own territory.
Mm-hmm.
And as we were coming out of the book on 9/11, we made a phone call completely by chance on a completely different subject to a former FBI agent in the United States. And at the end of the conversation, he said, you know, I was a little disappointed you were calling me on this obscure FBI matter because I sort of hoped you were calling me about my grandfather. And it seemed very strange to us, and we said, your grandfather? And he said, yes, he was commander-in-chief of the U.S. Fleet in the Pacific in December 1941, and that was Admiral Kimmel, the then hugely distinguished admiral in charge of not only the Pacific Fleet, but by title in charge of the entire U.S. Navy seagoing ships, and he was made to bear the brunt of the blame for the surprise at Pearl Harbor. And thus prompted, we started digging and investigating, and we found that it should not have been so, that it was, as Vice President Joe Biden has quite recently called it, perhaps the greatest injustice in U.S. military history.
Wow.
And that has taken us down an investigation for the last 2.5 years.
Did you know anything about Admiral Husband Kimmel at all before you, just almost by happenstance, bumped into his grandson?
Well, I think that we, rather like a lot of Americans, had read some of the reports over the years, both vilifying Kimmel and some of those that sought to defend him. So we had that as a starting point, but there was so much out there, so much of it conspiratorial, that needed to be weeded through before we could get to any of the new evidence or the truth about Pearl Harbor.
And by the way, Robin, Admiral Kimmel did become the scapegoat for this. I mean, he was drummed out of the Navy, wasn't he?
He was indeed. And one of the things that we found most disturbing was the way Kimmel and Short were railroaded into retirement by their vilification after Pearl Harbor. A new document we found, the transcripts of telephone conversations between admirals in Hawaii and Washington, discussing how Kimmel's sought-after request for retirement had been achieved, and we print those transcripts for the first time in our book, not the way that
they were manipulated into retirement.
Mm. Yes, mm. Not the way that an honorable man should be treated.
Now, by the way, folks, in case you're not familiar with our guest, Anthony Summers and Robin Swan, they are dedicated researchers. They've written about a lot of other subjects. For heaven's sakes, they are Pulitzer Prize finalists, for goodness sakes. So I didn't want you to get the wrong impression that they were somebody, you know, trying to climb on the bandwagon here for the 75th anniversary of Pearl Harbor. Anything but. However, I'm sure that there are people, Anthony, who say to you, how many books have been written about Pearl Harbor? Could there possibly be anything new? You've actually run into that sort of a reaction on some of your other books, haven't you?
Yes, but it's, you know, the last page of history on almost any event is very rarely written. It's a vast canvas, and we have found that true on this, as it was on our previous book on the 9/11 attacks, when there was blanket coverage, obviously. But if you sit and mine away at the information, one often finds bits of information that, when you really look at them and when you tie them in with all the other factors, they become important. One thing that may perhaps have slightly misled your listeners was the notion that you and I suggested just now that our focus was Admiral Kimmel. Well, our focus is Admiral Kimmel, but this was the commander-in-chief of the U.S. fleet in the Pacific. And that meant that we had to look at the whole canvas and look at other allegations and supposed evidence of sinister goings-on to deal with Pearl Harbor. And that we have. And the one that is embedded, really, in the American consciousness is the notion, the allegation, that President Roosevelt may have had some sort of foreknowledge of Pearl Harbor, but because he wanted to get the United States into the war, he kept it quiet, sat on it, and allowed Pearl Harbor to be attacked with all the tragedy that came from that. And we found that that was completely baseless. There is absolutely no evidence, in fact, rather the contrary, that the president or his the man he wanted to be allied to, Prime Minister Winston Churchill of England, had any foreknowledge at all.
I'm glad you researched that, because I've heard that. I've actually read that. And you say it's absolutely baseless.
Yes, well, one of the things we did, and we've been very lucky in that we've been able to do research not only in the American archives, but archives in the Netherlands and in the UK as well, but in British government archives, we found a report written for Prime Minister Churchill after the war, a handwritten report detailing the intelligence that the British had available to them at the time of the Pearl Harbor attack. And in fact, rather than the British having had more intelligence of Japanese movements from signals intelligence, which is what has always been rumored, they in fact had far less than the Americans. So there was no quiet backdoor conversation between Churchill and Roosevelt that we have ever been able to locate, and there is no evidence that such a conversation or such manipulation took place.
That's a fantastic bit of information explored in this book. Again, listeners joining us a little late, the title is A Matter of Honor, Pearl Harbor, Betrayal, Blame, and a Family's Quest for Justice. Why the title, Anthony Summers, A Matter of Honor? I mean, his family, the Admiral's family, worked for years and years and years trying to clear his name, didn't they?
Well, and so did the Admiral himself until his death in 1968. We've just been talking about what information U.S. And British intelligence may have had. What we haven't touched on yet goes right to the reason of why this was, putting the blame on Admiral Kimmel was a huge injustice. U.S. intelligence clearly had a great deal of information before Pearl Harbor that should have been shared with the guys at the sharp end, in this case Admiral Kimmel, that would have indicated to him that there was a risk to Pearl Harbor. Now, we found that it's always been known that there was some information that was not shared with the Admiral. We found more evidence, and it is really that the story is an indication that just as with the 9/11 attacks, There was a systemic failure of U.S. intelligence. Vital information, in some cases, never even made it to the top at U.S. headquarters in Washington. It just got filed and forgotten, and it was information that, had it been known to Admiral Kimmel in Pearl Harbor, in Hawaii, would have alerted him to the fact that he needed to take certain measures and that there was a real risk to his fleet.
I want to talk specifically about a couple of those things. We need to take a quick break here. We'll pick up our conversation, listeners. Folks, this sounds like a thriller, right? And this book reads like a thriller. You have to pinch yourself every once in a while to realize that it's all true. We'll pick up our conversation with Anthony Summers and Robin Swan here on It's Your Turn on WISR right after these words.
Butler Health System is more than a community hospital. It's a community of expertise trusted by our neighbors across the region. For renowned surgeon Dr. Tony Maloof, that means his neighbors are connected to a modern network of exceptional care.
While I'm part of a very close-knit group, I'm also a part of something bigger. Every day, I can see the difference this makes for my patients and for me.
But in its heart, Butler Health System retains the genuine caring of a community hospital, where patients are treated like friends and neighbors, because that's exactly who they are. And for orthopedic surgeon Thomas Mazzanegro, that caring is where it all begins.
We're committed to providing the absolute best care, and that means understanding what's important in the lives of our patients.
At BHS, we know what it takes to provide the very best of care. But more importantly, we know why we have to. Caring hands, remarkable minds. That's Butler Health System.
For so many of us, a loving pet is, well, it's a member of the family, isn't it? If you're looking for a veterinarian you can trust when it comes time for a checkup or treatment for a pet that's ill, consider Suburban Animal Clinic and Dr. Dennis Damon, Route 8 south of Butler, 4 miles south of Butler, right at the intersection of Route 8 south and Thorncrest Drive. Dr. Damon treats small animals, dogs, cats, all small animals, and exotic pets, too. If you have a question about illness, symptoms, shots, a checkup, if you need to talk to someone about concerns with an aging pet or a pet near the end of life, you can trust Dr. Dennis Damon. He loves animals. He's a pet owner himself. Dr. Dennis Damon, veterinarian at Suburban Animal Clinic. Hours by appointment only, Monday through Saturday. Credit cards are accepted, and he makes house calls, too. Dr. Dennis Damon, Suburban Animal Clinic, Route 8, 4 miles south of Butler at the intersection of Route 8 and Thorncrest Drive. Phone 287-5289. Welcome back, listeners. We're in a fabulous conversation here on It's Your Turn today with the co-authors of a new book on Pearl Harbor. The title is A Matter of Honor. Our guests are Anthony Summers and Robin Swan. My name is Dave Malarkey. We were talking before the break. Anthony, I think I was chatting with you about some of this information that should have been shared with Admiral Kimmel at Pearl. One of the tidbits that I found in your book is the fact that the Navy intelligence had hard evidence that new technology made it possible to drop airborne torpedoes in water as shallow as the water is at Pearl, but nobody told him. Is that what hit the Arizona and the Nevada and the Oklahoma? Was it these airborne torpedoes that they weren't expecting?
Well, not the Arizona, because the Arizona was hit with a bomb.
Okay.
This was the terrible episode in which the Arizona was destroyed, and as many as 1,000 of the 2,000-plus casualties at Pearl Harbor were suffered on the Arizona. But let me let Robin take that question. It is crucial information about the perfection of the aerial torpedo and what could be done with it that was not passed to Admiral Kimmel.
Well, only this past year we found in files in the National Archives that a secret report by an American naval attaché stationed with the British had supplied information, including a map that showed that the British had perfected this aerial-borne torpedo technology and were able to successfully drop bombs in waters as shallow as some 24 feet, while the water at Pearl was 45 feet. This information came into Washington in February of 1941, and it sat in a drawer in the Office of Naval Intelligence until last year. Mm. It was never passed to the Chief of Naval Operations, Harold Stark, who was desperate for this kind of intelligence, and it was certainly never passed to Admiral Kimmel. Now, if that information had been made available to those two men, the decisions we know that they made after that, during the months right before the attack, decisions about placing torpedo nets at Pearl, even though it would have been grossly inconvenient to the movements of the fleet, decisions about spacing, berthing, key decisions, may well have been very, very different.
There's one other thing I want to explore that I found very intriguing. And folks, believe me, there's so much. This is an incredibly detailed book. It's 500 pages with a great index, too, by the way. But talk a little bit, if you will, about the code-breaking system known as MAGIC. I'd never heard of this. I've read quite extensively about the European code-breaking and Enigma, the Enigma machines, and Alan Turing, and so on and so forth. I didn't know anything about MAGIC. What was this all about, and why was some key naval officers keeping mum after Pearl because of this?
Well, MAGIC has been known about. MAGIC was the jumbo name for the breaking of enemy codes. In particular, the Purple Code had been broken. This was the high-level diplomatic code. The Americans were able to read the messages sent to their senior diplomats abroad. MAGIC by name and MAGIC in fact, because it was an extraordinary, it offered U.S. intelligence and U.S. politicians a huge advantage. They were looking in, as it were, at the cards of the potential enemy before those cards were played. The information, however, was poorly handled. It was treated as such a big secret, and of course it had to be a secret. It was treated as such a secret that it was initially confined to be read by only about 10 people, and read in an unsatisfactory way. The information was given to them and then snatched away, just in case it was found lying around, and the secret about the secret got out. The person who could have benefited again from such information and the way that the nations were moving towards logjam to war never got to Admiral Kimmel in the Pacific. But there were other things from U.S. intelligence were gathering that also didn't reach him. It wasn't part of MAGIC, but warnings came through various intelligence channels indicating that Pearl Harbor specifically might be a likely target, and that information was not shared with the admiral or with the army in Hawaii.
Well, then what exactly was Admiral Kimmel accused of? Just some vague dereliction or not paying attention, or was he actually accused of anything specific?
Well, the charges were rather vague. Kimmel was supposed to command by mutual cooperation with the Army commander in Hawaii, General Short. And in spite of the fact that the evidence said that the two men actually cooperated in an exemplary fashion, the investigations managed to suggest that they didn't know enough about each other's operations. The other charge made was that Kimmel's long-range reconnaissance planes were not flying out. Well, it had been known all year that Kimmel did not have enough planes to fly a 360-degree reconnaissance at Pearl Harbor, and he had been begging for sufficient planes to do so. They never arrived. To adequately defend Pearl, therefore, he would have had to have very good intelligence on a potential threat to Pearl. He did not have this. He could not expend his limited aircraft in a fruitless search day after day after day. You cannot do that. You cannot keep men on general quarters day after day after day. So the charges against Kimmel were really tragically unjust.
Look, crucially put, I mean very, very simply put, he was made a scapegoat. And the Army commander in chief in Hawaii was similarly made a scapegoat. Why? Well, surprise, surprise, the buck was being passed. Just to quote from two modern messages that we found in the correspondence. In the 1980s, a special assistant to the Secretary of the Navy for Intelligence wrote that my predisposition, in quotes, would be to reinstate Kimmel to his original four-star rank, because Kimmel and Short were, this is a quote, given the character of the times and the character of President Roosevelt, quote, necessary scapegoats. And in 2002, after Congress had voted for the admiral and the general to be reinstated to their original ranks, another official reported to Deputy Secretary of Defense Wolfowitz, it is clear that others share at least as much, and in my opinion, even greater responsibility for the magnitude of the defeat at Pearl Harbor. But they still have not been restored to their former rank, and we were at the unveiling of a statue in Kentucky just a couple of days ago, a statue of Admiral Kimmel put up by the people of his hometown. He was born in Henderson, Kentucky. And the family are hoping, you asked about the family just now, they're hoping against hope that at last he'll be restored posthumously to his full rank, which is the only way now that he can, his reputation and his honor can be restored.
Listeners, did you know about this? This is such an incredible story. I didn't know anything about it. It's a wonderful book, A Matter of Honor. Let me ask you one final question, folks. Our guests, Anthony Summers and Robin Swan, they're not only New York Times best-selling co-authors of this book, they're also married, and they live in the Republic of Ireland, the land of my ancestors, by the way, as you might well have guessed, with the last name of Malarkey. So you work together.
We chuckled.
I'm sure you did. A lot of people say that I, you know, took that name because of the business I'm in. I said, no, it's a good Irish name and a real one. You can ask me, Daw, that's for sure. But tell me a little bit about working together. That's got to be kind of tough. I mean, you guys were in intensive research for years and years and years. Of course, you've done this before. I guess you know how to do it, huh, without getting in each other's nerves.
Oh, I don't know about that. you weren't here 20 minutes ago, Dave. This kind of research takes incredible discipline. And we like to think that every time we do a book, we're getting a little bit better at using the skills we learn. And we also feel privileged to do this kind of work. We've had an opportunity to write about some of the biggest and most important stories of this past century, and that is a privilege, and one is, has an obligation to try to get it as right as possible, and write it as well as possible so that people can understand the world around them, and that's what we hope we've done with A Matter of Honor.
Of course, there is strife, strife between any pair of people, trying to write a book together, arguing about facts and so on. But that's also an advantage, because you play mental ping pong and you move things forward by thinking aloud together. And it's worked for us for a long time, and may it continue.
Just mentioning a couple of the previous books of our guests, The 11th Day, The Full Story of 9/11, and Osama Bin Laden, The Arrogance of Power, The Secret World of Richard Nixon, and many other critically acclaimed books. Our guests, co-authors Anthony Summers and Robin Swan, authors of this meticulously documented account of Pearl Harbor that really does read like a thriller. The title is A Matter of Honor, Pearl Harbor, Betrayal, Blame, and a Family's Quest for Justice. Anthony Summers, Robin Swan, thanks so much for your time. I enjoyed the conversation immensely.
So did we.
Thank you.
Okay, so long now.
Thanks, Dave. Bye-bye.
More to come as we continue our tribute to veterans this day before Veterans Day. Everybody knows about Pearl Harbor. What do you know about the Battle of Midway? Pretty important battle. And this past summer, we celebrated a very significant anniversary. I had a chance to chat with Timothy Orr about the Battle of Midway. It's coming up next. And then Omaha Beach, D-Day. One of our sponsors on the program today, as we salute veterans, is Miller Shoes. Their Veterans Day sale is underway. Yes. and some great bargains. 20% off all men's and women's shoes in stock. 20% off. 15% off SAS shoes, America's favorite comfort shoes. And by the way, the sale runs through Monday. So if you can't make it in today or tomorrow, plenty of time to take advantage of the tremendous Veterans Day anniversary sale. Athletic shoes, men's and women's shoes, 20% off. SAS comfort shoes, 15% off. And don't forget, Miller's your headquarters for overshoes and boots, too, with bad weather just around the corner. Celebrating their 125th anniversary and celebrating their big Veterans Day sale right now through Monday. Miller's Shoes, 215 South Main Street in downtown Butler. Listeners, on the It's Your Turn program, this segment here on WISR, my name is Dave Malarkey. We're very pleased to be able to chat for a few minutes about an important anniversary of one of the key battles of World War II. Our guest visits with us by telephone. He is Timothy Orr. He is one of the authors of a book entitled Never Call Me a Hero. A legendary American dive bomber remembers the Battle of Midway. First of all, Professor Orr, nice to have you with us for a few minutes here today. Nice to meet you, sir.
Yeah, nice to meet you.
This June marks the 75th anniversary of the Battle of Midway. I dare say most Americans, if you said, what's D-Day? They could probably give you at least a general answer. Perhaps not the Battle of Midway. And that's kind of sad, isn't it? We don't want this to get lost in history.
Yeah, it's definitely a shame because, you know, at the time it happened, I think most Americans kind of realized this was an important victory. Not only did it eventually set up the American offensives in the Pacific, but it somewhat got vengeance for the American losses at Pearl Harbor, because in a single day, four Japanese carriers were sunk, and they were the very ships that were used to launch the Japanese planes on December 7, 1941. And so it was a day that was remembered when it happened, and I really think it should be a day that should be remembered with the 75th anniversary.
So Pearl Harbor was December 7th, 1941, and the Battle of Midway was June of what year, sir?
June of 1942,
okay.
So about 6 months after the loss at Pearl Harbor.
And many consider the Battle of Midway, because, you know, the American Navy fleet was devastated at Pearl Harbor, but Midway was kind of a turning point. The United States, they'd been on the losing end in the Pacific up until the Battle of Midway.
Yeah, that's true. They didn't just lose at Pearl Harbor, but they had also lost the Philippines. A massive army under Douglas MacArthur is forced to surrender the previous month in May. The Americans lose their territories at Guam and Wake Island, and they had fought something of an inconclusive battle near Australia called the Coral Sea in May 1942. So the story of the United States and really all the allies in the Pacific was a sequence of defeats, and then Midway is kind of the first big victory to kind of help turn it around.
Well, that sets the stage for us to talk a little bit about N. Jack Dusty Kleiss, who is this legendary American dive bomber who's the subject of your book. And my goodness, he lived until he was 100 years old. He just died last year.
Yeah, that is correct. We were lucky enough to know him prior to his death. I mean, we spent 4 years working with him so we could get his story correct and exactly as he wanted it. And his long life, I think, was part of his decision to want to write this memoir. He was a very religious man, and he kind of was always asking himself why God had kind of spared him, not only in World War II, but spared him to live long enough to be the last member of his squadron still alive. And he kind of thought that maybe God had given him some sort of mission to tell the tale, because no one else was left to do it. And he thought that this would be something of a fulfillment of his last kind of mission on Earth. And so, he kind of eventually decided to do it, which was a big decision for him, because he's was a very modest man. You know, he did not like to be the center of attention. He did not like to have the spotlight on him. And when we first proposed the idea 5 years ago, you know, he kind of said, well, I don't know why anyone would want to read a book about me. And, you know, my wife and I, we were like, are you kidding? Your story is amazing. It fits well with this important battle called Midway that people really need to remember. And we think that your perspective will help turn up interest in it. And so he kind of reluctantly agreed to it. And I think as the years went by, he got more and more excited about this book. And it's very sad that he couldn't live long enough to actually see it in publication, but here it is, and it's going to be his legacy, I think.
Timothy Orr, listeners, our guest is Associate Professor of Military History at Old Dominion University. That's in Norfolk. And he mentioned briefly his wife, Laura, Deputy Education Director at Hampton Roads Naval Museum. They, along with the late Dusty Kleist, the co-authors of this book. And he had a great deal of help from his daughter as well, I think, right, Mr. Orr?
That's right. His daughter, Jill, his youngest daughter, wrote a very nice foreword for the book where she kind of describes kind of her relationship with her dad and with the stories that he told about the war and about Midway. And one of the things you kind of gather from it is that, you know, Dusty, like many World War II veterans, kind of kept quiet about, you know, a lot of the tragedy that he witnessed. And so he didn't really start speaking about, you know, the, you know, these stories until, like, the 80s or even the 90s, you know, years after they had happened. So, you know, he wanted to kind of put the war behind him for a while, but as life went on, I think he found the courage to kind of return to some of these tragic tales. And if you read the book, you'll see that, you know, a lot of his stories are just simply the losses of friends he had on USS Enterprise who were killed in battle or died simply by accident by flying these kind of, you know, dangerous craft, these dive bombers.
Captain Dusty Kleist received the Navy Cross. Listeners, that should tell you a great deal right there. He's obviously credited with playing a decisive individual role in determining the outcome of the Battle of Midway. But I understand, Professor Orr, it is not a stretch to say that the U.S. might not have won the Battle of Midway if it wasn't for Dusty Kleist. Can you tell us exactly what he did during that three-day battle?
Yeah, sure. He's the only pilot that we can confirm that hit three enemy ships during that battle and helped sink all three of them. So he sunk two Japanese carriers in conjunction with his squadron mates, the Kaga and the Hiryu, on June 4th, and he sunk the Makuma, a Japanese cruiser, on June the 6th, again, in conjunction with his squadron mates. And so you might say he probably killed more enemy sailors than any pilot in the air during those 3 days. And, you know, the substance of it is that sinking these Japanese ships was vital to the American victory in the Pacific, because they would not have been able to mount an invasion of the Western Pacific in the years following if those Japanese ships had been operative, because they were big, they were powerful, they were full of experienced Japanese aviators. They were really the flower of the Japanese Navy. And they suffer a critical blow on June 4th when Dusty and his squadron mates sink four carriers in 1 day. And so, you know, Dusty is not the only one to do some amazing action during that battle, but he is certainly one of the most important. And it kind of lends credence to this idea that, you know, even one individual's actions, one individual life, can make all the difference between victory and defeat. How many battles can we say that happens at? You know, Midway is definitely one that I think that stands up to that idea.
We're nearing the end of our time. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about a dive bomber, if they're not familiar with that plane? I assume they were carrier-based. Is that right?
That's right. They could be launched off of land, too, but they're carrier-based planes. They're two-seaters with a pilot and a rear-seat gunner, and they do an incredible thing. They go up to a very high altitude, usually about 20,000 feet, and when they see a target, they drop straight down about 80 degrees towards the target, 275 miles an hour, and at the very last second, at about, you know, 2,000 feet, they drop their bombs and then have to pull out. And it's a very dangerous and terrifying ride, but it was the most effective way to hit a moving target out on the ocean, because you couldn't really do level bombing to strike something. So dive bombing was a tactic the Navy had perfected prior to the war, and it works really well at Midway.
Well, as we wrap up, I just want to mention, in addition, folks, to being a great history of the Battle of Midway Dusty's great service on that day, this book also emphasizes the journey of his life as he became an elite dive bomber. The title is Never Call Me a Hero, a legendary American dive bomber pilot remembers the Battle of Midway. One of the co-authors we've been pleased to chat with here on It's Your Turn, Professor Timothy Orr. Thanks, Professor. Thanks for being with us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Sure. So long now.
Whether you're a competitive athlete or a weekend warrior, any injury that keeps you on the sidelines is not one worth having. The sports medicine specialist at Tri-Rivers Musculoskeletal Centers will help you get back into action so you can keep up your lifestyle. Our experts understand that the same treatments for competitive athletes can be used for those who just want to be able to stay active. They accept major insurance plans, including both Highmark and UPMC. Learn more about how you can get back on the field by visiting TriRiversMSK.com.
Welcome, listeners, and delighted to have you with us. And on this segment of It's Your Turn, author and historian John C. McManus, who joins us by telephone right now. John, nice to talk with you again.
Good to be with you. Thank you.
I say talk to you again because you and I had the occasion to chat on the publication of your book on the American side of A Bridge Too Far, September Hope. For listeners who may be joining us just a bit late on this segment of It's Your Turn, my name is Dave Malarkey, and John McManus joins us by telephone talking about a book that he has published entitled The Dead and Those About to Die, D-Day, The Big Red One at Omaha Beach. And the Big Red One, of course, was the first infantry of the U.S. Army, right, John?
That's right. They were the first infantry division actually created during the World War One era, and in those days they were simply known as the 1st Division, and by the time of World War II, the Army had sort of expanded the title a little bit to call them the 1st Infantry Division, but of course their famous nickname is simply the Big Red One.
And they were combat experienced by the time the invasion of Normandy rolled around, because the 1st Division had fought and fought valiantly in earlier two earlier campaigns in North Africa and in Italy, right?
That's right. They were heavily combat experienced, and especially with amphibious invasions. They had spearheaded the invasion of North Africa during Operation Torch in the fall of 42, and then had done a lot of fighting in North Africa that winter of 42 and 43. And then they led the way into Sicily in July 1943 and had, quite a fight there. So you had, a real core of solid combat veterans who populated that division. Of course, the division had suffered heavy casualties, too. So, in the run-up to D-Day, you're getting a lot of new replacements, too, and these guys have to be trained and kind of amalgamated into what is something of a unique esprit de corps. But the 1st Division veterans were mostly unenthusiastic about getting into yet another invasion assignment.
Were you, in the course of your research, John McManus, were you able to chat with any veterans of the campaign on Omaha Beach who are still alive and who were still able to talk about it?
I did, and it was the kind of thing, and the book sort of evolved out of this, that I've been studying Omaha Beach for many years, really. And so over the years, I had spoken with quite a few veterans from the 1st Division, this is part of what sort of germinated my interest in it. I felt like some vital aspect of the Omaha Beach story had been lost, that it's not as if the 1st Division was necessarily overshadowed, but I think we tend to fixate elsewhere when we look at Omaha Beach, and so I felt this was something of a new way to look at it. So I'd spoken with quite a few guys. I'd corresponded with people over the years. People had sent me memoirs. Of course, unfortunately, now, in the last year or two, there really are very few left. Veterans, as I'm sure you realize, are going fast, unfortunately.
It's difficult for people today to get a scope of the size of this invasion of D-Day, this invasion of Normandy. Number one, in terms of the number of troops involved, and in number two, of the size. Omaha Beach was one of, what, five invasion beaches altogether?
That's correct. You had you mentioned Utah Beach, of course. That was the other American beach. And then you had two British beaches, Gold and Sword, and then a Canadian beach, Juno Beach, which was sandwiched between Gold and Sword. And those three were east of Omaha Beach. So Omaha Beach is really the vital connective tissue of the whole Normandy invasion, and really some of the toughest terrain that's going to have to be taken.
Let's talk a little bit about that again for our listeners who are not that familiar with it. Utah Beach, which was the other American beach and the one most furthest to the west, when you go to Utah Beach today, I mean, it is literally out in the middle of nowhere. There's a couple of huge monuments there on the beach, but otherwise there's nothing to be seen. Omaha's a little bit different. There's a little resort town that's not too far away from Omaha Beach.
Right. Omaha Beach is it's almost a kind of a ridge line overlooking a very narrow, quite rocky beach. And you have cliffs that border Omaha Beach on either side. It's a sort of a crescent-shaped beach, about 4.5-5 miles long. You've got cliffs in the east, and then cliffs in the west, Pointe de la Perse, and then even, you know, farther to the west of that, more famously, Pointe de Hoc, of course.
Mm-hmm.
So at Omaha Beach, you have these little towns of Vierville, Colville, Cabourg, Saint-Laurent. These are a little sort of farm town, resort towns. That had grown up there over the years. And so you've got buildings and other structures that sort of, in addition to some of the high ground, just kind of brood over this really rather narrow, rocky beach. So it was always going to be a rather difficult objective, and that's one of the reasons why they assigned two divisions to invade it, the 29th and, of course, the 1st.
That gets to exactly what I want to talk about yet next and, of course, what you detail in your book. Utah Beach, pretty flat, not so easy to defend, but Omaha, just the opposite, with these high ridges surrounded by cliffs. And all you got to do is look at it, and you can visualize the difficulty that an invading army would have trying to get ashore without a tremendous loss of life, with the cliffs up above being heavily defended. How do you approach this, John McManus? Do you try to look at the 1st Division coming onto Omaha Beach as a whole? Do you break it down with the 5 or 6 or more individuals that you were able to talk about and give their story? What was your approach?
Yeah, my approach is always from the bottom up, to tell the soldier's personal story, to basically humanize these guys again, because I think that as we get farther and farther distance from the event, people tend to become more one-dimensional in that sense, particularly those who lost their lives. And I was fortunate in really being able to drill down deep and find a lot of tremendous sources, rich source material that could give us a sense of what it was like on D-Day morning and afternoon at Omaha Beach for the 1st Infantry Division, but also what they were like, you know, what were the relationships and the interplay, and who did what? Who were the key people? And so in this book, you really get to know a remarkable diversity of individuals who I think played very important roles for the Big Red One on D-Day. That, to me, is what's fascinating, the human story, in a sense, by bringing them to life, we bring this monumental event to life again. And even all these decades later, this becomes possible because, you know, so many of these guys left behind good memoirs, questionnaires that the great Cornelius Ryan had gathered for his great classic, The Longest Day. But also, after-action combat interviews that historians of the time did, interviews I've done, I mean, oral histories, I mean, you name it. There's a lot of really good stuff out there. So I'm able to look at this. My hope is to sort of create an effect where you as a reader are sort of put in there with the 1st Division on D-Day and maybe get immersed in it and get a little bit of a sense of what it might have been like.
Yes, and you do that very well, letting us meet individuals like the former minor league pitcher, Joe Pinder. I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly.
Right.
He's the guy who saved a vital radio on that morning, June 6, 44.
Right, and as any commander will tell you, communications are vital to any military operation, and obviously Omaha Beach is no different. And Joe Pinder was a really interesting guy. He'd had a very strong minor league baseball career as a pitcher. I think it's very possible, I'm not a big baseball fan, I've studied his career a little bit. I think it's possible he might have had a shot at the major leagues at some point, but he was a patriotic guy who immediately signed up for the Army when the war broke out, so he'd been in the Big Red One for quite some time since they fought in the Mediterranean. He had a very solid reputation. He was something one of these on-site leaders, and so on D-Day morning, he's part of the communications section of the 16th Infantry Regiment, which is the lead assault unit for the division, and he keeps going back out of the water to drag these heavy radios, you know, heavy, bulky kind of radios you have at the time, almost analogous to, if you can imagine, like an oversized window air conditioning unit, mm-hmm. sort of a piece of equipment like that. And he keeps going out there to where the fire is heaviest to preserve this stuff and bring it in. And he's heavily wounded. Really could have just sort of checked out at that point and gotten treatment. Instead, he keeps going back into the waves, and ultimately it costs him his life. And he earns the Medal of Honor. He's one of three men from the division who received the Medal of Honor for their actions on D-Day.
Midday lottery numbers for today. The pick two is 7575. Pick three is 391391. Pick four, 8670. Pick 5, 25198. Wild ball for each of those is 5. The treasure hunt, 3, 8, 15, 23, and 26. Estimated jackpot for tomorrow's treasure hunt is $10,000.
Looking for a way to make your company's benefit package a little more competitive? Here's one that's so easy, more than 130 local organizations and businesses have added it to their programs. Membership in Armco Credit Union. At Armco Credit Union, your employees will have access to the best loan rates and more free banking services, while direct deposit and payroll deduction options make it convenient for both of you. And best of all, it doesn't cost you a thing. Learn more at armcocu.com or by calling 284-2020. Armco Credit Union is an equal opportunity lender and is insured by NCUA.
Welcome back, listeners, joining us a little bit late on It's Your Turn here on WISR today. That's fine. Dave Malarkey is my name. Our guest is World War II historian and author John C. McManus. We're talking about his book on the invasion of D-Day, The Dead and Those About to Die, D-Day, The Big Red One at Omaha Beach. I think most people realize that the film Saving Private Ryan was fictional, but there have been many who have suggested that the first 20 minutes of that film give the common person more of an indication of what D-Day was like on Omaha Beach than anything else. Would you comment on that, John?
I think it's a pretty good look at Omaha Beach. I think it portrays it very well, and there are some inaccuracies here and there. They have the log obstacles are pointed in the wrong direction, for instance. At the fighting that they portray is at Vierville, which is the extreme western edge of Omaha Beach, and they didn't quite go straight up the draw as is portrayed. They went around the cliffs that border the western side of Omaha Beach. But by and large, the spirit of it is right on, and one of the things I found in my research on the Big Red One is that the fighting over on that side, on the eastern side of Omaha Beach, if anything, was probably even worse than is portrayed in that film, if you can even imagine that. And I one of the things I did is went through the unit records to really get a sense of the actual casualty numbers, and they're pretty troubling. It's probably about 1,100 to 1,300 casualties for the division just on that day alone, and that doesn't include all the units that were attached to them, which is probably about 500 more casualties. And you can imagine a lot of these are fatalities or MIAs who were never recovered, and so the cost is really significant, and especially for the 16th Infantry, which has the leading role for the 1st Division and absorbs that terrible, terrible circumstance during H Hour and the first 3 to 4 hours that tend to be the worst on D-Day.
H Hour was what, John McManus, about 6:30 in the morning?
It was 6:30 in the morning, and they chose that because they wanted to invade at low tide. And the reason they wanted to invade at low tide at Omaha Beach is the planners had a real nagging sense of how many obstacles and mines were coating the beach by the time of D-Day. The Germans had been working very hard on that. And so about one out of every four of the soldiers who hit the beach that morning was an engineer, and they wanted to come in at low tide so that you could see the obstacles before the landing craft would hit them. They figured at high tide, the obstacles would be under the water and the landing craft would be very vulnerable. So the Germans didn't really expect that. They thought the U.S. would come in at high tide. So that was a bit of a surprise to them. But for the soldiers, coming in at high tide was really even more dangerous because there's all this open ground you have to cover, and you make a perfect target. So, yeah, you see the obstacles better, but that doesn't help the average soldier all that much. It just makes him more exposed.
And the engineers didn't have that good a time of it removing the obstacles. In fact, almost nothing went as it was planned for the Big Red One on Omaha, right?
Right. I mean, the plan is out the window within the first few minutes. And one of the reasons is that they had expected amphibious tanks to swim into the beach and provide fire support. Well, most of them sank in the heavy seas. 27 out of 32, for instance.
Wow.
with an average of one man lost per tank, lost, you know, dead per tank. So the tanks aren't where they're supposed to be. Others are coming ashore to provide some support, but it's nowhere near as many as you'd hope. And the engineers, these special combined teams of Navy, Army engineers that I call gap assault teams, that are supposed to clear those obstacles, well, of course, they're caught in the middle of this firepower, and then you got soldiers trying to take cover behind the obstacles, too. So even if you can wire up your charges as an engineer, you know, you're not going to blow the charge because you don't want to kill your own guys who are cowering behind the obstacles. It becomes a complete mess that everyone on the beach has difficulty doing his job.
And in the meantime, the German forces are up on top of the ridges, up on top of the cliff, firing down from pillboxes and bunkers, some of which, hauntingly, are still there, aren't they?
Quite a few are still there. In fact, you know, for instance, at one little strong point, which is the closest to Omaha Beach, to the sort of the waterline, and it was called WN61. The German term is Widerstandsnest, and so it basically means strong point. And there's a heavy bunker casemate there that contained an 88 millimeter gun, one of only two 88 millimeter guns at Omaha Beach on D-Day. But now that bunker has been restored, and it's a rental home, a rental property for someone there in Normandy. So it's almost surreal in that sense. Of course, then others in other spots of the beach, you can only get to by really walking a great distance, and they're quite overgrown with the foliage in the summer. So there are, you know, there are whiffs of World War II to still get as you walk Omaha Beach, believe it or not, after all these years.
It's been some time since I was there, John McManus, but there was still a partially submerged mulberry out there in the water when I was there off Omaha.
There were some chunks of it here and there. You won't see as much anymore. I mean, of course, at Aramanche, where the British Mulberry Harbor was, you do see it out in the water, a lot of it. What you'll really see at Omaha, and this is quite interesting, especially if you know if any of your listeners are planning to go there, take a look at the rocks. It's a very rocky beach with these smooth stones that comprise kind of a shingle bank on D-Day, which is only vestiges of that are there, but the actual rocks are still there today, and you can look, pick them up, and you can see some of those rocks are scarred by ordnance, undoubtedly from the battle on D-Day morning. I have quite a few myself, and I show one of them as I go and give talks about this new book, and I just think that's fascinating to have that kind of tangible link to history in that way.
It is true that much of the German high command had actually left Normandy, obviously taken by surprise, at least with regard to the date of the Allied invasion.
That's the irony of the whole thing. Field Marshal Erwin Rommel believed everything would be decided on the day of the invasion. He wanted to stop the Allies right at the waterline, and no more so than at Omaha Beach, where really he wants to just kind of pin you onto that beach and rake you over with fire from the high ground above. Well, the Germans did not have as good of information on weather forecasts than the Allies, because they didn't control a lot of the North Atlantic. They believed that the weather front that was sort of converging on Normandy on June 4th and 5th would continue on the 6th, making an invasion possible. So Rommel actually went home to celebrate his wife's birthday, which was, ironically enough, June 6th, and to have a conference with Hitler. So he wasn't there on D-Day.
And the vagaries of war. The weather was, in fact, bad. In fact, Eisenhower, D-Day was originally supposed to be June 5th, and Eisenhower delayed it by a day because of this very weather that you're talking about.
That's right, and this was obviously an enormously stressful decision for him. He basically had a window of 3 days, June 5th, 6th, and 7th, to have the right tidal conditions, the right moon conditions for the airborne landings, and so on and so forth. And so June 6th was his second option, and really not that desirable an option, because they knew the weather still wasn't going to be all that great. They were looking at a hole in a front kind of thing. And that's actually one of the things that sinks the tanks I mentioned earlier, the swimming tanks. Basically go down because the seas are very choppy because the weather is not all that good. And the other thing, too, the weather limits visibility a bit at Omaha Beach, and I think that that's a factor in why a lot of units are mislanded off course in what are pretty bad spots to land near the draws, where there's a lot of heavy firepower.
Did that happen to the Big Red One? Did they have a lot of landing craft that landed in the wrong place?
In fact, most of the first wave landing craft end up in the wrong spot, and you really couldn't have picked a worse spot to end up in because they get deposited too far eastward underneath the draw where the heaviest German defenses happen to be. And like E Company and F Company, 16th Infantry Regiment, are by and large just slaughtered. The casualty rates are 60% and upward. There are a few exceptions, and one which I talk about in some detail in the book is one boat section under John Spaulding, Lieutenant John Spaulding and Tech Sergeant Phil Stresek, which does hit in the right spot. It's not an easy landing, but it's kind of a dead spot in the German defenses. And I believe, just in my study, this is the first American group to get off the beach, and they inflict tremendous damage on the Germans throughout the day.
We're talking with John C. McManus, author of The Dead and Those About to Die, D-Day, the Big Red One at Omaha Beach. Just a couple of more questions, Don. I got to let you go. There were two waves, I think, right? There was one right at 6:30. Wasn't there a second wave? Was the Big Red One involved in that as well?
Right. Both divisions have multiple waves throughout the day, and this is where it can get a little confusing sometimes because you'll have sometimes a veteran will say, I was in the second wave or I was in the third wave. Well, if you look at the original landing diagrams, I mean, you're talking dozens of waves throughout the day. So what wave is which and whatever can be very confusing. So as an historian and as sort of a purist, the second wave to me means, probably about 45 minutes after H hour when you're seeing, the rest of, say, 2nd Battalion, 3rd Battalion, 16th Infantry come in. But there are landings going on throughout the day on this kind of minute timetable that pretty quickly gets blown. That can lead to even more problems because now you're having troops and vehicles pile up in bad spots, presenting more targets. And so this is another reason why it's so vital for these first groups to get off the beach. And that's where the title of the book comes from. Only two kinds of people are going to be on this beach, the dead and those who are going to die. Colonel George Taylor, commander of the 16th Infantry, just says that over and over and over throughout the day. And it's important because it gets people off the beach, and if you're off the beach, you're really a hunter. If you're on the beach, you're pretty much a target. And that's what kind of turns things at Omaha Beach in the course of that late morning and early afternoon.
As the sun went down on the evening of June 6th, did Eisenhower and the other Allied leaders, did they sense that the invasion was going to be a success, or didn't they know yet?
They knew they had a beachhead, that they hadn't been repulsed. Eisenhower was especially pleased that the airborne landings, the U.S. airborne landings, hadn't been the complete, total failure and bloodbath that some had feared. And I know that's a particular interest to you because your father was in the 82nd Airborne Division. This was a real concern for Ike that the paratroopers would be slaughtered. Now, certainly they were scattered, and they were in all sorts of difficult situations, but by and large, it was successful. Utah Beach had gone well, and the British and Canadian beaches had, so they had a sense that the invasion had worked, but they were really worried about what would come next and, what kind of German counterattacks would happen. And, of course, D-Day is only the beginning of an 11-month bloody campaign to conquer Nazi Germany. It's just really the first step, notable though it was and dramatic though unquestionably it remains.
And Omaha is, of course, the bloodiest of the D-Day beaches. 19 hours of hell for the Big Red One, as detailed exquisitely in John McManus's book. We must mention as we close, John, we would be remiss if we didn't. Sitting right up above Omaha Beach to this day is the American Military Cemetery. And you can be at the cemetery and look down over Omaha Beach. It's pretty emotional to be up there.
Yeah, there's no doubt. I encourage everyone who can to visit that cemetery. There are 9,387 Americans buried there, including almost 100 men from the 1st Division who lost their lives on D-Day and about another 10 on the Wall of the Missing. And, I was able to visit all of their graves individually during my studies. And, my hope was to bring them to life once more somehow in looking at this. And also, what's really moving to me is hearing from the family members of a lot of these folks, and not just, those who were killed in action, who maybe find out a little bit more or some things they didn't know. That's extraordinarily gratifying to me as an author to be able to do that and to be that close to history in that sense.
the D-Day invasion. And if you want to read about one crucial part of it, you would do very well to pick up a copy of John McManus's just published book, The Dead and Those About to Die, D-Day, the Big Red One, at Omaha Beach by renowned military historian John C. McManus, with whom it's been our pleasure to talk for the past while. Thanks, John. Good to talk with you again.
A real pleasure. Thanks so much for having me on.
Okay. So long now.
Take care.
The Young Funeral Home of Butler invites you to stop by their Jefferson Street location, downtown Butler, to talk about pre-arrangements. Not the easiest thing to do, but necessary. And the Young family will walk you through the process, making it very comfortable and really easy to take care of. You'll experience peace of